Pass the salt, will you?
Pass the salt.
Pass the salt, amigo.
It's time. It's time.
I think they could give us a new name. I believe we are Evan Jellyfish.
Hey, will you pass the salt?
Pass the salt.
We need salt over here.
It's time for Pass the Salt.
Pass the salt.
But we like to share the gospel without any backbone to it, see?
The views, opinions, and seemingly outrageous comments expressed in this program are based on the Holy Spirit leading of a man called Coach.
I gotta ask you this out there, Christian America.
It's time for Pass the Salt with a coach, Dave Dobenmeyer.
Oh, good morning out there, America, or good, as Robin Williams would say, good morning, Vietnam. Thanks for joining us here today. We got a great show for you today. And we're going to be joined here in a few minutes by Dr. Edwin Vieira. And for many of you, you say, who? Who's Dr. Edwin Vieira? Yeah, that's sad that that would be the situation that we're in here in America. Dr. Vieira is one of the world's most renowned constitutional experts. I have a funny little history with Dr. Vieira. I don't even know if he remembers this. Back about 6, maybe 7 years ago, I was doing this out of my other studio, and I did an interview with Dr. Vieira on this very thing that we're talking about here, and he gave me 45 minutes, an hour of his time. We did a fabulous interview, and at the end of the interview, I realized that I had not hit, you got it, the record button. So I thought, well, what do I do? Because that information was so good, and he was so gracious to give me his time. What am I going to do? Great interview. Nobody can hear it.
Hello. So,
I swallowed my pride and picked up the phone and called him back. Said, you're not going to believe this. I did not record it. And he graciously said, okay, well, so we did it again. So our kind of guy. And that one of his claims to fame, we'll get him in here in a second, that we're having some technical issues. He probably gets sick and tired of hearing this, but Dr. Edwin Vieira is the big brother, I believe, of Meredith Vieira, well known on CBS News, and I don't even know where she is, which stations or which news department she's with. But that's his baby sister, I believe. I mean, it's definitely his sister. I think it's his baby sister. And I've had a real affinity for Dr. Vieira and his constitutional muster and everything that he knows. In fact, if you would, real quick, Connor, pull up. It says gun freedom. Here's a real good, real quick bio for you on Dr. Vieira. Do we have him? Is he able to hear us yet, Jared, Connor?
He's in here.
Okay, great. Well, pull up that one that says his bio, because I don't believe we're able to, because of technical issues, he's not going to be able to join us probably by video. So we'll get a good verbal lecture from him. Here's Dr. Edwin Vieira's PhD, expert on the United States Constitution, graduate of Harvard Law School. I'm playing with the monitor I can read this test on. Harvard Law School. Make it a little larger if you could, Connor. And a member of the bar of the Supreme Court of the United States, Dr. Vieira has four. How about this one? How about this? Dr. Vieira has 4 degrees from Harvard. 4 degrees from Harvard. In particular, he's a graduate of Harvard Law School. He's been a member of the bar of the Supreme Court of the United States for 42 years. During that time, he's argued and briefed numerous cases involving constitutional issues before the court. Most recently, he has submitted an amicus brief in the important Second Amendment case, Colby v. Hogan, a copy of which can be found at scotusblog.com. So there's all the books he's written. He is the go-to guy. By the way, if we get a chance to get into it a little bit more, there's one of his books, 13 Words, Masterful Study, the First 13 Words of the Second Amendment to the United States Constitution. We're going to talk about that. But he's also, folks, a constitutional money expert. What? Yeah, gold, silver, the dollar. What's all going on in that that realm as well? So we're honored that Dr. Vieira be able to join us again. And Dr. Vieira, we connected the other day last week when I wrote a commentary about what is your plan, and he kindly sent me an email, said he appreciated what I'd written, and his real heart is, how did the word militia, how did that ever become an M word, a word that you're not allowed to say? It's happened because of a misunderstanding of what the militia was all about. The Second Amendment to the Constitution. Jared, I was going to send you that. I don't know if I did or not. If not, maybe you could pull it up. Just go to somewhere and pull up the Second Amendment to the Constitution. And that's what Dr. Vieira's book, 13 Words, is about. Exactly the importance and the significance of that Second Amendment and what it actually does say. I'm not trying to steal your thunder here, Doc. I'll get you in here in a second. But here it is, very, very simply, the Second Amendment. A well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. And we know right now that if you use that word militia in a church, they're going to grab you by the cuff of your collar and throw you out the door. In most situations, most places that you go, this has become the new N word, but it's an M word, militia, because people think violence and rebels and all that stuff. But that's because we don't have a clear understanding of exactly what's going on. Dr. Vieira, are you able to come in and can you join us here? Are you there? Yes, sir. Hang on, folks. Bear with us here a second.
There you go. I'm here.
Yes, sir. Dr. Vieira, thanks for joining us. And
My pleasure. My pleasure.
You'll hear my little introduction there. Let's dive into this. Brother, just open up your mouth and teach us and explain to us how the militia word became the M word.
If you look at the Second Amendment in context, you understand that it relates back to the original Constitution. All of the provisions of the Bill of Rights were enacted for the purpose of preventing misconstructions or abuses in interpretation of the original Constitution. And you find in the original Constitution provisions that give Congress powers to organize, arm, discipline, train the militia, and to call forth the militia for three purposes: to execute the laws of the Union, suppress insurrections, and repel invasions. So these were entities at that time, so-called militia of the several states. That's in Article 2, referring to the president's power as the commander-in-chief of the militia of the several states when they're called into the service of the United States. These were entities that actually existed when the Constitution was ratified, and they had existed going back into the earliest colonial times. You'll see even the charters of the colonies always had provisions for the proprietors, they were called the king's friends, who went over and set up the colonies, to organize the inhabitants in militia structures. And the purpose was from the beginning to provide protection in the colonies from the king's enemies, whether that was the French or the Spanish or the Dutch or the Indians, whatever. Because there was no standing army-type structure within the American colonies. And these institutions developed in all the colonies according to essentially the same pattern. They involved every adult male, which was generally from 16 years of age on up, free adult male, able-bodied adult male, because obviously people who were not able-bodied couldn't participate. In a structure which was compulsory, everyone was required to perform some function within the militia. Most were armed and trained in a military or paramilitary sense, because that was the major problem that they faced at the time. Even the women, who were not, as we say today, emancipated by law, I mean, they were in a different legal context, they had certain duties, primarily financial, with respect to the militia. They would have to provide guns. If you were a widow and you had a son, a minor son, who was to be enrolled in the militia, and you were then required to pay for his equipment. All right, so this was a structure that the Constitution adopted, and it adopted it for the reason that's stated in the Second Amendment. If you look at the Second Amendment, the important thing is that security of a free state. That's the goal. Second Amendment is looking to the security of a free state. And I just want to focus on those words, a free state, because that's, in a sense, most people look at that as a peculiar term. Well, it refers back to the concept of republican form of government. That free state designation was another way of saying republican form of government. Anyone who knows German knows the German word Freistaat, which breaks down into two words, free and state, but it's a single noun, Freistaat. And the general translation of that from German into English is republic. All right? So the concept of a Republican form of government was twofold. First, there's a procedural aspect of it, that people were going to govern themselves through representatives as opposed to direct democracy, in which everyone came to a town meeting or something and voted. We're going to have representatives because, as James Madison said, in a large extended republic, you can't run it as a direct democracy. You have to run it through a representative form. And then the other concept, the underlying concept, was in a republic, who is the sovereign? Well, it's the people themselves who are the sovereigns. And sovereign power, ultimately, is the power to exercise the ultimate degree of force. George Washington, there's a quotation attributed to him, government is not eloquence, government is force. So the whole concept of Republican form of government was based upon the idea that the people themselves would rule themselves, would exercise sovereignty by having under their control, ultimately, the final level, the decisive level of force in the community. And that brings us back to the Second Amendment, which states that clearly. What is the thing that the founders believed was necessary to the security of the free state, of the Republican form of government? Well, it would obviously be the people organized in some military or paramilitary way, and that was the concept of the well-regulated militia. And a well-regulated militia, one of its aspects is that the people are armed and trained, and therefore we come to the concept of the right of the people to keep and bear arms not being infringed, so that the people can function in the well-regulated militia, so that the militia can provide service to the security of a free state, so that we can maintain a Republican form of government. And it all ties together in that way.
So now, how did it become a word says that it was necessary for the security of a free state. Now, one of the things that's happened over time, certainly back, you know, one of the arguments would go this way, that there was no military, so the founders came up with a way to be able to do it, and they did through the state militias because we had no standing army. But when we went into war for the war for independence, then we became a nation, and then we began to fund our government, and so the need for the militia is no longer there because we've got the federal government's taking care of us, and they call down the National Guard, and this whole militia thing isn't even necessary anymore. Isn't that the argument, Doctor?
Well, that's what people say, but you don't interpret the Constitution on the basis of implied repeals. All right? The Constitution is a particular structure that was created. The founders understood that all the parts of that structure had to be there and functioning to maintain the goal that they wanted. And the ultimate goal, as I said before, was this maintenance of a Republican form of government. You know, during the colonial period, it wasn't simply the militia that provided what I would call the military protection for the colonies. You also had the British Army. Now, the difficulty with the British Army was that, it came from British Islands, right? So it wasn't always there. They had some troops there, but it was very expensive to maintain a large army within the colonies. And there was a third element called the provincial troops. And you find all of those in the Constitution of the United States today. Congress has the power to raise and support armies, to provide and maintain a navy, so that's one aspect. And then there's the militia on the other side, Congress's powers to organize, arm, train, discipline, so forth, the militia. And this third part, the so-called provincial troops, or the state troops, if you look at Article 1, Section 10, Clause 3, it says that no state shall maintain troops or ships of war without the consent of Congress. So if Congress and the states consent, you can have a structure of state troops, and that's the National Guard. Most people don't understand that. There's the regular army, there's the National Guard, which are the state troops, and then there are supposedly these militia structures. And actually, if you go into the state statutes and federal statutes as well, you'll see that that's still there. Now, they are what I would call moribund. The average person doesn't even know of the existence of these structures. He certainly doesn't participate in them on anything like a regular basis. And the reason that the word became, well, first of all, shall I say, it went out of favor because at the turn of the 20th century, there was a statute passed in 1903 called the Dick Act, which purported to, I guess you'd say, regularize or modernize the militia structure. And it created a category called the unorganized militia, which is where most people find themselves if you look at the legal structure. And I guess those people at that time thought, well, all we needed was the National Guard, which was this new concept that he created, and the regular army. And once again, there wasn't, as you pointed out, they thought, well, there wasn't a need for this structure without understanding what the purpose of the structure was. The demonization of the word really begins in the early, as I recall it, in the early 1960s. There were a number of groups of, what shall I call them, just to be fair to them, radical elements who formed themselves into what they called militia. One was known as the Minutemen. It was someplace out in Montana or Idaho or whatever out in the West. And this was during the Kennedy administration, John Kennedy's administration. There were some people out there who thought that the Kennedy administration was too left-wing and that the people had to organize themselves to oppose what they perceived as a socialist movement or even maybe a communistic movement in around some of the people that Kennedy had as advisors. In any event, those people were, how should I put this, they were really on the fringe. They didn't understand what they were doing. They didn't understand the constitutional principles involved. And they made a bad name for that word. Well, of course, also, there's a group in this country that very much wants to prevent the people from participating directly in government the way the Constitution requires them to do. Mm-hmm. And the militia is that concept, all right? The militia is not some kind of private organization that you set up in your neighborhood. It's part of the entire governmental structure of this country, and that's why it appeared in the original Constitution. That's why it appeared in the Second Amendment. That's why, if you look at the actual history of the states after the Constitution was ratified, you'll see militia statute after militia statute after militia statute being passed by the states. But the grave difficulty was that the purpose that the militia served during the pre-constitutional period pretty much petered out domestically in this country after the Constitution was ratified, because we didn't have domestic warfare until the Civil War. All right? Civil War comes up, all of these structures are now revivified, and you had militia units in both the Union and the Confederate forces. In fact, Lincoln, when he took his first step to deal with the secessionists, he called out 75,000 members of the militia in order to, as he said, to suppress this rebellion, as he called it. All right. So you had the militia functioning during the Civil War. Then after the Civil War, of course, people were tired of bloodshed. 600,000 men had been killed in the course of the Civil War. They were tired of bloodshed. And the militia became, to a very large extent, ceremonial. Social functions were performed. I mean, it wasn't something that was typically following the traditional militia pattern of really arming and training people. In fact, that's why the National Rifle Association was formed. It's very interesting. The National Rifle Association was formed by a number of Union generals because they had seen in the Civil War that the boys were coming in not knowing which end of the rifle to point at the enemy. And they wanted this private organization. It always had connections with the standing army, but it was still a private organization. They wanted a private organization in order to train people to understand the use of arms so that if they were called up in an emergency, they would have at least minimal training and familiarity with the use of the basic rifles and so forth. But now, that's fascinating because they were performing, the National Rifle Association was recognizing something that the Constitution already required, but people had stepped away from.
Dr. Vieira, I think it's important, Dr. Vieira, that people understand, again, Coach Dave Dobbin here with Dr. Edwin Vieira, the Second Amendment, let's think about that just for a second. The First Amendment, we know what the rights that are clearly spelled out in the First Amendment. But it's very amazing, Dr. Vieira, that they chose this idea not of the right to keep and bear arms. I mean, that's part of the Second Amendment. But they chose to put at the first part of the Second Amendment a well-regulated militia being necessary. So apart from the well-regulated militia, if we don't have that, then the ability, the right to organize and bear arms becomes something just, it's just hunting and, you know, protecting yourself and shooting squirrels and all that, when in fact that was not what their plan was at all. In order for the security of a free state, I always thought it was interesting that they didn't talk about a free federal government, but a free state, is because they were in fact organized state by state by state. Because as we see in America today, the federal government has totally gained so much power that the ability of a state to be able to stand up for the people within the state has almost evaporated. Would you agree with that?
Well, absolutely. And if you look in the Constitution, Article 2, Section 2, the term is the militia of the several states. There's one in every one of the states. Started off with 13, and now supposedly we're supposed to have 50 of them. And what we have here is, as the growth of federal power developed, obviously they wanted to limit, number one, the power of the states, and then number two, the power of the people, because as I said before, in a Republican form of government, the people have the sovereignty, not the public officials, not the politicians, not the political parties, not the special interest groups, right? So they wanted to limit this. And I think that the opponents of the Constitution in modern times have been much more astute than those people who call themselves patriots and constitutionalists and conservatives or whatever terminology they use. Because the opponents have recognized that you have to remove the foundational structures in order to twist the Constitution, manipulate the Constitution to their own goals. And the militia is the ultimate foundational underpinning of the Constitution. Because what the concept says is, who is supposed to exercise this ultimate level of force? Who is supposed to be organized, trained, disciplined, and armed to perform that function? Well, it's not the regular army. The Founding Fathers were very leery of standing armies. And that's why you see in the Constitution that a standing army can exist, appropriations at least, for only 2 years. Because every 2 years, what happens? The House of Representatives turns over. And the House of Representatives is the branch of Congress in which all appropriations bills have to start. So they left the power in the House of Representatives to say, well, we're not going to fund a standing army anymore. Right? It may have been done 2 years earlier, but now we have a new House of Representatives. We're not going to have a standing army at all. So although they allowed the concept in the Constitution, they gave this check and balance by limiting the appropriations to a 2 year period. As far as what we call the National Guard today, that requires the mutual consent of the states and Congress, because those are actually state troops. And if you look at the structure of the National Guard and the way people join and what they do and so forth and so on, it's pretty obvious that that's not a regular army, although the National Guard can be subsumed into the regular army under certain circumstances, which happened during colonial times. The provincial troops would go off with the British Army. All right? They were part of essentially the regular forces. And then the third branch is the militia, and the militia were understood to be those people, essentially every able-bodied male, and today the females would participate to a certain extent, who would be the local arm, right? Maintaining control at the local, county, state level, whatever, within each one of the states. And that would be the ultimate check. If you look at this structure, that's the ultimate check and balance, right? If the army goes bad, if these state troops go bad, which has happened historically in other countries, right, where the army becomes rogue, what is the final protective force for the people within the Republican form of government? Well, it's the people themselves.
Well-regulated militia.
The well-regulated militia. And, of course, the opponents of having the power of the people in control have demonized that. First, they demonized the concept. Right, so this is bad. These are crazy people running around the woods with guns, and they're quote-unquote anti-government. And then, of course, they attacked. Their second step was to attack what's called the individual right to keep and bear arms, because obviously if an individual doesn't have a right to keep a gun, he can't possibly function within a militia. So these things all go together. But they're all directed towards limiting the ability of the people themselves to exercise the sovereignty that a Republican form of government requires them to exercise, and to leave the power then in the hands of some kind of self-determined elite that's going to tell the rest of us what to do.
Okay, so let's say that where we are in America today, that like here in Ohio back in 2004, I believe it was, we passed a marriage amendment. Reaffirmed that marriage is between a man and a woman. Reaffirmed that. The federal government struck that down. But a well-regulated Ohio militia would have been able, had the governor or the elected official said, listen, no gay marriage here in Ohio, the well-regulated Ohio militia would defend the right of the people of Ohio from the federal government. Is that the way that it's supposed to work, Dr. Beer?
Well, it would have defended the people of Ohio from the effects of that Obergefell decision.
The tyranny of it.
And see, we get into some interesting situations here, because if you look at a decision of the Supreme Court, they have floated the idea, especially since the 1960s, that when the Supreme Court gives a decision in a case involving two particular parties, somehow that decision applies to everyone else in the world.
Yeah, it's crazy.
Well, it's crazy because that's never been the way the law works. Right. The law works as a court decision applies to the parties before the court. It doesn't apply to anyone else. So there's really no determination on the part of a court in that kind of a case that within every state, in all other circumstances, what they decided, and I think wrongly in that particular case, we'll leave that aside, what they decided in that case is going to apply elsewhere. And the militia concept would simply be, as you said, the governor in the state of Ohio, whatever state it was, would simply say, well, the Supreme Court made its decision between the parties in that particular case, but that doesn't apply, number one, to the government of Ohio. It doesn't apply, let's go down to the local level where the marriage licenses and marriage recordation occurs, right? It doesn't apply there. And we are not going to allow some federal bureaucrats or federal officials to come into our particular state and attempt to impose on us the statement in those opinions. All right, so you get into this exact question, is the exact question of delineation of authority, right?
Right.
And it would be a deterrent. People always think of these things, excuse me, in kind of hyperbolic or extreme situations, right? But the point is, it's deterrence. We have that right now. You think of a member of Congress. If he's going to vote for something, he has to look over his shoulder and say, "What's this going to do to me at the next election?"
Mm-hmm.
Right? He may be threatened by all sorts of political forces within his district who are telling him, "Oh, if you vote for that bill, you're finished. We're going to remove you from office next time around." All right. So that's one level of deterrence, the electoral level of deterrence. There's another level of deterrence, which is the judicial level. Oh, if somebody does such and such, we're going to take this to court and see if we can't get a decision out of whatever court will give it to us. The third level of deterrence is, well, we're not going to, at the local level, at the state level, we're not going to cooperate in the enforcement of some unconstitutional action that you're trying to impose upon us.
Mm-hmm.
All right? Not that necessarily it's going to come to blows. We're simply not going to cooperate. As Nancy Reagan said with respect to taking drugs, just say no. We're going to say no. We're not going to do that. And we have the ability, lurking in the background, we have the ability to stand up to you, the federal bureaucracy or whatever, whoever is threatening to impose this on. We have the ability to stand up to you because we are organized, armed, trained, and we have governmental authority. We are part of the constitutional structure just as you are. And that's how you distinguish between the militia concept and what most people call the individual right to keep and bear arms. And so there's no question that Americans have an individual right to keep and bear arms. But your individual right does not make you a governmental actor. You don't have governmental authority simply because you can go to the gun store at today, some places, and buy an AR-15 rifle. All right, you're a private citizen, and that ownership or possession of a firearm doesn't in and of itself give you any governmental authority. As soon as you become a member of the militia, which theoretically every American is supposed to enroll in when he's 16 years old and on up, then you are a participant in a governmental entity in the same way the people in Congress are, the people in the parts of the federal bureaucracy that might be legitimate or what have you. You are part of a governmental structure. And in fact, if you look at the hierarchy, the theoretical hierarchy, you are part of the most important governmental structure because you're the only, or that structure is the only one that the Constitution specifically says is necessary for any purpose. Wow. Constitution doesn't say Congress is necessary. It doesn't say the president is necessary. It doesn't say the judiciary is necessary. Mm. Theoretically, we could probably do without those in a last case scenario. It says only that a well-regulated militia is necessary. Those things called the militia of the several states, those state governmental entities.
Jared, if you could real quick, or Connor, Dr. Vieira just happened to post at newswithviews.com yesterday, or I read it yesterday, a commentary on this very thing. I don't know if you can pull that thing up there so that we can see it. And folks, by the way, I also have, we're going to put it into the chat. You go to YouTube and you type in Dr. Edwin Vieira, and you're going to be shocked with the number of videos that are going to come up. And if you want to get educated on the Constitution, the true meaning, the original intent of the Constitution, spend an afternoon watching Dr. Vieira's videos that are there. They're really, really, really informational and an originalist. What that
question? Can we ask a question, Coach?
Sure, come on in. Come on in, Mark.
All right, yeah, quick question. Can you speak about what happens when the executive branch exercises their authority to dispatch the militia in a malicious way? For instance, let's say Bernie gets elected and he's in favor of these Antifas. Mm-hmm. Well, he could use the militia to be in, you know, to support Antifa against a rebellion of free people, right? So can you speak on that?
Number one, he could use the regular army. Number two, he could try to use the National Guard. And I would think the regular army and the National Guard would be more likely to follow his orders than the average person in the militia. But the interesting point about the constitutional structure is, and let's talk about the President of the United States, he's the commander-in-chief of the militia of the several states. When they are called into the actual service of the United States, that's a quote, Article 2, Section 2, Clause 1. Look it up for yourself. The actual service of the United States. Now, why is that word actual there? From the point of view of just plain English, it wouldn't be necessary. You could simply have written, when called into the service of the United States. The word actual is an emphatic term. It's telling you, wait a minute, we're not going to have the pretended service of the United States. We're not going to have some unconstitutional action that the president is simply saying is the service of the United States. It has to be the actual service of the United States. And in a Republican form of government, who is going to determine what that is, ultimately speaking? Why, the people themselves. So you could have Bernie Sanders, whoever you want to pick out of that list of Democratic candidates, saying, well, I'm going to call forth the militia to perform these unconstitutional functions. And the militia, I would hope, if the people were constitutionalists, if the people actually understood what our structure of government entails, the members of the militia would say, and the governors, because the governors in every state that I know of are the commanders-in-chief of the militia at the state level, the governors would say to Mr. Sanders, well, this isn't the actual service of the United States. We're not coming out for that. And
gotcha.
That's the deterrence. Because now what's he going to do? Is he going to set the army against the militia? Is he going to try to set the National Guard, the state troops against the militia? This creates a, what I call the political deterrent effect. Far away from, you know, shooting or whatever, you know, violence.
Or
whoever
could be the
wants to engage
on
in usurpation.
Yeah.
Has to think about the consequences of beginning a course of usurpation. And what we have now is the average person doesn't participate in a militia structure. They're really not there. They're in the statute books, but they're not there in actuality. And so he's left with no ability to deter the kind of situation that you're positing.
So the point is, Dr. Vieira, you cannot connect the Second Amendment without talking about the Ninth and the Tenth Amendment, which are states' rights. So if we say in Ohio, we're not going to kill babies anymore in Ohio, the government that is closest to the people is the government that is most responsible to the people. And we in Ohio, through our elected officials, say to our governor, we don't want to kill babies here in Ohio. Then it could be the duty of the governor of Ohio to call up the well-regulated militia of the state of Ohio and say to the federal government, not here. You are not going to do that here. Correct?
Well, I don't suppose that they even have to call the militia up in the sense you're using it. The militia standing in the background here, and the governor saying, well, we're not going to go along with this program of abortion, and we're going to close down the abortion clinics or whatever. We're going to take some action here to make that policy effective. And we're not going to allow federal agents to come in and thwart what we're doing.
Amen. Yes, sir.
But doctor, then they're going to withhold federal funding for the state.
Okay.
Well, you know, we have a very complicated structure, a rat's nest or a spider's web, if you will, of all sorts of unconstitutional, what shall I call them? I mean, the structural situations that have been created, and the funding is one of them. They've bought off state political leaders and, in many instances, large segments of state populations, the electorate, with so-called federal money. And it's fascinating. If you go back to some Supreme Court decisions on this, they have actually said that the government can use federal money to achieve purposes for which it has no constitutional authority. I mean, that stops you. That should stop you cold when you read that. But that's what they've said. They can use federal money to usually through imposing conditions. We'll give you the money if you do this, is the way those systems work. We'll give you the money if you do this. The this that they're saying they want the states to do or the localities to do is something that they can't require the states or the localities to do. They have no specific power to require that. And yet the Supreme Court said, well, you can bribe them.
Sounds like a quid pro quo to me, Doc.
Well, to use that word. It's bribery. It's a form of bribery. And it's amazing because one would think that, wait a minute, if you don't have the power to do this at all, how could you possibly have the power to attach that as a condition to spending money? Right, because the spending of the money is actually effectuating this non-existent power. How is this possible? Well, we have these kinds of problems. And we have these kinds of problems because for a very long time, the vast majority of the people in this country have been willing to sit back and essentially pay very little attention, or in some cases no attention, to what's going on in the transmogrification of their legal system, the corruption of their legal system. And I have tried to point out to people that one of the fundamental reasons for this was that the average person was not participating directly in a militia structure. If you had all militia structures in this country the way they were supposed to be, going back to, you know, whenever, the turn of the 20th century, if they had done the right thing in 1903, you would have had people paying much more attention to what was going on, not only in the federal government, but in their state governments and their local governments, because the militia have responsibilities and authorities at all levels. And as a result, I would have thought that the politicians wouldn't have been able to get away with what they have gotten away with.
Mm-hmm. Amen.
All right? This is like the sleeping giant concept, right? The giant has been sleeping all this period of time. And meanwhile, right, the rats have been gnawing away the foundations of the governmental structure. And now we see where we are.
Yeah, Dr. Vieira, let Jack come in here a second. Come on in, Jack.
You're muted, Jack.
Jack, you're muted, bud.
Talk to me. Would you touch on use and function of a committee of correspondence and a committee of safety so that the towns, the individual towns, can set up their militia structure?
Well, you're going to need some kind of collective action in terms of first education. People have to understand what the Constitution requires of them. All right? This is a compulsory structure. I always think about people talking about the individual right to keep and bear arms. Yeah, you have an individual right, but you have an individual duty as well. That's something that always seems to evade this discussion, right? If you're at least an able-bodied male from 16 years of age, you have an individual duty to have a firearm and be trained and so forth so that you can function in the militia. So the first thing is education. The second thing is exactly how you go about effectuating the educational component. And we have to recognize that the militia are state institutions, as the Constitution uses the term, militia of the several states. And then they have local bodies. So typically there would be county militias and city militias, town militias, whatever the governmental structure is within a particular state. And I have tried to get people to say, look, the only way to accomplish this is to go at the local level and start talking to your local emergency management people. And here in Virginia, I'll give you an example. You have FEMA coming out of Washington, and they have created all sorts of training programs and whatever for dealing with emergencies. And so we have a Virginia Emergency Management Agency. And the Virginia Emergency Management Agency in our statute requires that all of the local bodies set up an emergency management plan. And pretty much that comes out of Richmond and eventually out of Washington, D.C., and the local, here we have a Board of Supervisors. Whatever the local jurisdictional authority is, they pretty much follow that plan. But they have the authority under the Virginia law to, to add to whatever plan comes out of Richmond. And I have said as an example, well, that's what should be done. The local body should say, wait a minute, we need, as part of our emergency management plan, we need to have some kind of organizational structure set up at the local level among our local citizens. Basically, the only thing you have now is a thing called CERT, Citizens Emergency Response Teams, which are voluntary groups of people who sign up to work with the 9/11 people, the fire people, and so forth. But there's nothing like a militia because there's nothing compulsory about it, and the training is minimal, rudimentary. So this was my idea at the present time. You need the local governments to come up with a plan for essentially revitalizing the militia without necessarily calling it a militia because of the demonization of the word. And then at a certain stage, when that has been done, you take that up to the next level, which in here would be the state level, the state legislature, and you say, look, we've come up with this plan for reorganizing our local citizens to deal with all these emergency situations, and we now want a statute amended, because we already have a statute in Virginia that talks about the militia. We want that statute amended so that these structures that we have created are going to be called militia units. We revitalize the thing up from the bottom to the top. And we do it at the state level, because it's not going to happen in Congress. That's obvious. If you go to Congress, they're going to look at you sideways and say you're some kind of an anti-government extremist. It has to be done at the local level and done in the context of educating people to understand, wait a minute, if we have all sorts of potential emergencies on a large enough scale, we are totally unprepared to deal with them. See, when people think of the militia, they think of that concept of keeping and bearing arms. All right. But a militia structure would deal with all sorts of other emergency problems. And some problems that wouldn't even necessarily be emergencies. They would just be continuous situations that we had to deal with. I think of Katrina. It's kind of a classic example. New Orleans, right? There's a city that's below sea level. and a huge hurricane is coming in. Everyone knows this thing is going to cause damage. And everyone knows that hurricanes hit the Gulf, right, and hit New Orleans. I mean, this is the first one they had. Were they prepared for that? No, absolutely not. They brought in FEMA. Was FEMA prepared for it? No, absolutely not. It was a disaster of the first magnitude after the hurricane hit, a disaster of non-organization, non-preparedness, not even ill-preparedness. And what was one of the first things they did? And this is notorious. They went around taking guns from people. Yeah, the chief of police in New Orleans came in and said, well, we're going to take all the guns. And once you look at that, you say, this is exactly, it's 180 degrees removed from what the Constitution foresaw was going to be the correct structure, and in fact requires as the correct structure. And if you had had a militia structure in New Orleans, a local militia structure, city militia structure, what would one of the things have been that that militia structure was concerned about? Security. Were those dikes going to hold if we had a big enough hurricane? Are we going to listen to the Corps of Engineers, the Army Corps of Engineers, who obviously didn't do the right job because the city was wiped out, you know, by the hurricane, right? The dikes didn't hold. The levees didn't hold. Right? You would have had direct citizen input in that particular state or that particular city, looking at the particular problems of that particular city, and having, let's face it, if they couldn't find enough engineers in New Orleans or Louisiana to solve that problem before it hit, I would have been very surprised. You know, within a militia structure in the state of Louisiana, they couldn't find enough civil engineers to deal with the threat to New Orleans, that they had to depend upon the Army Corps of Engineers. And so this is our problem, ultimately. If you look at the absence of the militia structure, what they have done is they have eviscerated local participation, and we have a state of dependency now. Yeah. All of our localities, and in many instances the states, are hopelessly dependent in critical situations upon some kind of aid, assistance, whatever, coming out of the government in Washington, D.C.
You know, Dr.
And we had FEMA not too long ago tell us, oh, we can't help you. Have 3 days' worth of food, water, medicine, whatever it is you may need, because we're not going to be able to help you in a crisis. Now,
this
FEMA
so
has
stupid.
Been here since Richard Nixon. Nixon set up FEMA, right? How many decades ago was that? And in that whole length of time, they have not been able to come up with a plan with all of the power and the money and the influence of the government of Washington, D.C. They have not been able to come up with a plan to actually protect people in their localities. Tell them, you got 3 days, and after 3 days, you're on your own. If we had militia structures, we would be laughing at these potential problems because we would have prepared.
See, Dr. Vieira, you and I are of the same generation. I remember in the 1960s in my elementary school and in my small community here, we had what was called civil defense. We were worried about nuclear bombs, right? And so local men became part of the civil defense, and their responsibility was to take care of the people in Hebron, Ohio, which really is nothing more than an example, an offshoot of what a well-regulated militia would look like.
Yeah, precisely. And in some places in this country, you can still find underground storage facilities where they had water and food and very, you know, whatever they thought they would need to survive the radioactive fallout. And you had training in the schools. Remember that?
Yep.
It wasn't just a training for fire. It was, what are we going to do if we get the nuclear attack warning? Right? And all of that went by the boards. It's all gone. That was just the vest. Let me go back historically, because history is the thing that you have to study to understand what's happened to us. World War II is looming on the horizon. And the Roosevelt administration realizes that if we go to war, you know, the Army and the National Guard people will all be sent overseas to two fronts, the European front and then to the Asian front. What are we going to do about protecting the homeland? What kind of a home guard, quote-unquote, structure will we have to protect us against saboteurs, against whatever the dangers might be? And so Roosevelt appointed two people to look into this. One was Fiorello LaGuardia, former mayor of New York, and he was a congressman at the time. The other was Eleanor Roosevelt. All right? And they had different ideas. LaGuardia had his idea, and Eleanor Roosevelt thought that it should be more of a social welfare function. And so, in any event, they went around in circles on this. And to make a long story short, what they did during the war died with the end of the war. Okay? And there's a book written about this, which is called, Darkness, something about darkness. It covers this whole area. Very interesting book. I'll remember it in a moment. But if you look at the index in that book, it doesn't have the word militia. You read the whole book, it doesn't mention the concept of militia. Apparently this didn't dawn on LaGuardia and Eleanor Roosevelt. Right? One would have thought that if you're facing this kind of problem, you say, well, we're not going to have the army, we're not going to have the National Guard to protect us. What does the Constitution suggest we ought to do? You would have run head-on into this word militia. You said, oh, that's it. And we don't have those properly structured. They're moribund. We have state statutes, but they're not being really enforced or implemented. That's what we need to do. And there was a reason that they didn't do it, although the book doesn't describe this. Defenseless Under the Knife is the title of the book, Defenseless Under the Knife. There's a reason they didn't do it. And the reason they didn't do it, I think, was because they ultimately understood that this was letting the genie out of the bottle. If you went and you revitalized, as I like to put it, revitalized the militia, and you told the people that you, the average American, you are the ones really in charge, they would never be able to regain the control that they had gained during the first half of the 20th century. And that's the problem we have now. That's the exact reason that all of these people out there, both on the pro and the anti-gun side of the Second Amendment business that's going on in the various states with regulation of firearms or gun control statutes, that's why neither side wants to talk about this word militia. Because the ones who want gun control, they certainly don't want to point out that gun control is there in order to prevent the people from exercising their ultimate sovereign power. And the ones on the other side have been, I don't know how you would put it, they've been embarrassed by this concept of militia that having been demonized, so they don't want to come out and raise this point. And as a result of that, this fundamental question, where are these institutions that the Constitution tells us are necessary to maintain a free state? It's never asked, and it's certainly never answered.
Amen.
Hey, Doctor.
Hang on a second, Larry. Just Coach. Real quick, I'll let you in. Hey, Jared, please put up in the chat Dr. Vieira's commentary that he wrote this week, 9/11 event, the president and the militia. It's very, very timely to what we're talking about. If we can pull that up and put it in the chat. I'm sorry, Larry. Go ahead.
Yeah, Doctor, I'd like to ask you a question that's kind of peripheral to the funding of militias and the federal army even. You know, a lot of people say that all spending bills have to originate in the House. But when I read the Constitution, I read that all bills for raising revenue shall originate in the House. Now, a spending bill that does not create a tax, does not raise revenue, that can initiate in the Senate, as long as it's merely an appropriations bill to spend money that's already there. But if it's for raising more money, then it has to originate in the House. Am I incorrect or what?
Well, I suppose it depends on raising revenue for what purpose, right? Are we talking about taxation? Are we talking about taking money that's in the Treasury and applying that to a particular purpose? I think the limitation on the Army is the two-year limitation. Oh, it's the appropriations.
Right. That's what I'm saying. The spending of money.
It's not the taxation provision or the borrowing provision. They can get their money any way they want. And theoretically, I suppose, well, you know what they do. They initiate the legislation in the Senate, then it goes to the House, and the House plays some game. And so as a result of that, I say, well, okay, the House has actually passed a bill because they changed a few words in it. They've initiated. And they go around with this. My point about the Army was, the Army's appropriations And logistics is everything, right? If they don't have the appropriations, there's nothing they can do. The Army's appropriations last for only 2 years.
Yeah, I fully understand that. Okay. But my question was not specifically about the Army's part in it, but about the different houses, the House and the Senate. The way I read the Constitution, it's the House is the only one that can raise revenue. They're the only ones that can initiate a tax to bring money into the government. But as far as spending that money goes, the Senate has the authority to initiate a bill that would spend money. That was
Absolutely. And we've had appropriation bills. A lot of bills have as part of their terms some kind of appropriation. Right? They're doing X, Y, and Z, and they have to spend some money on it. So Section 10 of that bill was saying we're going to spend $10 million on this.
Yeah, correct.
Right. And then the revenue question is, well, what are we going to do? How are we going to raise that money in the first place to put into the Treasury? Because no money can be drawn from the Treasury except as a result of appropriations made by law, right? That's also in Article 1. So how do we raise that revenue? Well, that starts with whom? With the branch of Congress, which is the quote-unquote popular branch, the one elected directly by the people, originally elected directly by the people, because originally the senators were chosen by the state legislatures. But it all ties together, because it brings you back to what? The members of the House of Representatives, and that's this Republican form of government concept, right? We're going to have representatives representing us. That's the House. And then the federal aspect of it, the states were going to have their representatives, right? The senators were there to represent the states. The representatives in the House were there to represent the people in general. And what they did with the Senate was to remove the authority of the legislatures to choose the senators and make it popular election. So that's another area, but of course there's a constitutional amendment that allowed that. That's another area where we moved away from the Republican form of the pure Republican form of government concept.
We're up against the clock here, Dr. Vieira. Jared, if you could click real quickly on his latest commentary there at News with View so people can see it, and then they can go download it and read it themselves. The 9/11 event, the president and the militia. And Dr. Vieira, I'd like to, you know, we'd love to make this you a regular part of what's going on, because I know that you have a lot of information on money and what they've done to us with money and what really true. I mean, a lot. So we'd love to have you come back and join us sometime. You know, the scriptures tell us that our people are destroyed for a lack of knowledge. There's just so much stuff that we've been taught that isn't true, and so much stuff that was true that's been hidden from us. And you know, we got a monstrous job in front of us. And all politics is local, and any attempts that we have to change this government is going to have to start locally. And that's why I think that you're really, really onto something here with the whole idea of the militia, even though the government and the media has made that a no-no, the new N-word. It's very, very important that we understand that that was the ultimate control of the local people over their government, was a well-regulated militia. And we have to somehow try to get back to that. We have to run, Dr. Vieira. If you would just hang in here with us after we close it out, because some of the guys here probably still have some questions for you. A well-regulated militia being necessary for the security of a free state. Man, oh, man, folks, we got a lot to learn and a lot to do. God bless you. We'll see you tomorrow.